the instrument has advantages and has disadvantages. I mean, like every instrument has, you know. And so I have written things that I just can't play. They're not possible for me to play, but they're actually very, you know, playable on a violin, for instance.
Welcome to the Banjo Studio Podcast from Banjo Studio, your source for the finest in North American-made banjos and Collins guitars and mandolins. Go to banjostudio.com on the web for an incredible selection of instruments and accessories.
Hello. In this episode, recorded July 29th, 2020, we hear from the extraordinary banjo player Jens Krüger, who is well known for a banjo style that integrates folk music with European classical music and for his performances with the Krüger brothers.
So I wanted to talk to you actually to start off with on the actually on the composition front, because I know you spent a lot of time writing tunes, and I've looked at your interviews, and it seems to be a central thing, because when I was looking back, it looks like a big part of your identity was when Bill Monroe telling you that you should really put your own stuff together. And I'm wondering what the process was of you figuring out really what the process is with your composition, what it is that you're trying to show, and how you came to you know, work with your techniques that you have on the instrument, and then to write for other instruments too.
Well, that's a question and a half, you know.
Yeah, sure, that's okay. If we only tackle this one, we're okay.
Okay, but is it okay if I give a longer answer? Okay.
Very okay. Very okay. We just listen over here.
Okay, so the thing was, you know, I'm from Europe, and I never had lessons. You know, we never had music lessons in our home, and so I'm just self-taught. I was lucky that I was around good musicians, and I mean, that helped, that I always, you know, had sort of the possibility of be with other musicians that were, of course, much better than me, and that always inspired me, and I listened to things. Sometimes I asked, you know, what was that, and they would tell me, you know, okay, that's that kind of chord that leads to that one, and so, and in the 70s, you know, when I played, there were not many books out, and of course, you know, I couldn't read music, and most of the books that were actually out that would have interested me, they were in English, and I couldn't speak English well. So when I was like 10, 12, 13, 14 years old, there was really not much information. There were a few people in Germany who had a few little booklets out about tenor banjo and things, but information was very rare. It was not much, you know, to get to. So I just tried to listen to it on the albums and turn them down to 16 speed instead of 33, like so many have, you know, just to listen to it slow, because the banjo has so many rapid notes following each other that it was just... and slowing it down was great, because it was pretty much an octave, you know, not exactly, but close enough. And then I could, you know, figure out licks. And of course, I played them not really right most of the time. And as when I was a kid, but I was fascinated by the variety of licks and things. You know, like chords. You know, for me, when I was like 10 years old, I could not imagine that anybody could name all the chords. It seemed like there were infinite amount of chords. And so I always thought to myself, they're probably secret chords. You know, like everybody figures out his own chords and textures. And then it's like his secret. It's like what he does, you know, it's like, and I could not even imagine, you know, that all these chords could be named. And so I made a little book, and I wrote in the chords that I figured out, because I played tenor banjo at the time. And I, of course, didn't know what the name was of the chord. And so I would write a little image to the chord, like, you know, cat sitting on a tree, or my garbage in front of the house, or, you know, something that reminded me of that sound. And I thought, well, if I have the book full of little images, I can make up stories and then play these chords. And that would be the idea of composing. So later, of course, I learned that that was all wrong, and then later I learned that it actually was all right.
yeah, how about that? Restart creative and end creative. That's quite good.
You know, so So, of course, later, you know, I bought a lot of books and music theory books and started really studying them and getting into it. But, you know, I was a street musician, and then I didn't have much time and much resources, you know, to get to information. But I learned from a lot of other musicians, and it's like street fighting, you know, you learn a lot of tricks and little things and little substitutions and little things you can do by just, you know, listening to other people and, you know, playing all day. You know, we used to play every day, all day. And that helps, you know, especially when you're young, to build up a certain vocabulary, and you got your bag of tricks that you can use, you know, and follow chord progressions and, you know, squeeze in anything that you could think of at the given moment. But you know, later I learned that there's a lot of traditional music and a lot of standards that Americans, you know. And so I went after learning a lot of Earl Scruggs and, you know, the standards, you know, the standard tunes. But then when I was invited to play with Bill Monroe a few shows, and that was really interesting, because, you know, I met a few musicians that were extremely, I mean, just unbelievable. I've never seen musicians on that caliber on playing that well. You know, for instance, we played a night in the Grand Ole Opry, and there was Chet Atkins, you know, playing right after us. And that was in 1982, you know, so a long time ago. I was 19, and I have never seen a guitarist play so beautiful, you know, in my life. You know, I sitting there, I was mesmerized. You know, I knew Chet Atkins' music, and we had albums at home. But sitting there, standing there backstage and listening to him play on that bar stool was life changing. For instance, because it was so beautiful, and I don't think he composed many tunes in his life, but he arranged things people knew on an extraordinary level, you know, and executed them so well. It was mesmerizing, you know. But Bill, you know, like you said in the beginning, you know, Bill Monroe said that I should, you know, maybe come up with my own music because I'm from Europe. And I didn't like to hear that, of course, but because I wanted to just play bluegrass. And he said, well, you know, bluegrass was barely enough for me. It will not be enough for you.
Interesting.
he was really good to me. He really let me play for him, and he would always say, "Yeah, that sounds like Earl Scruggs. That sounds like that. That sounds like that. But can you play something that is from you?" And so I played him a little, you know, just a little passage I came up with once, and then he said, "Well, that's you, whether you like it or not." I thought it was a really, later I really realized that was a great statement, you know, this is you, whether you like it or not. It's similar like when you look into a mirror, it's you, whether you like it or not, you know, I mean, this is what you got to deal with. This is it, you know, I mean, you can improve it a little bit and you can do things, but this is you, you know, you're not going to be taller or you're not going to be, you know, have a different skin color or whatever it is, you know, you don't like or you do like, it's just you, you know, you got to deal with it. And so that helped me a lot, you know, starting to accept, you know, that what my taste is in music is me. I thought that was the best advice I've probably ever gotten, because I could make so many thoughts around it. You know, out of that one idea, I could develop a lot of other thoughts, you know, for my playing. I would cautiously, you know, play something, and then if I like it, I would explore more. Do I find more that I like? Is there more that I like about this? Or the question basically is, am I playing this because I think somebody else might like it? There's nothing wrong with that either. But it's nice to, or is this something I learned so I can become a musician that gets hired and gets jobs, you know, in studios? Or that I can read, that I can read charts. So every learning aspect started for me to have a purpose. You know, there was a reason, and then there was these things that I could not use for anything really, because I was playing in bluegrass bands and country bands. You know, and nobody wanted to hear the music that I was writing because it didn't sound like something they knew. Right, so it was, I mean, not revolutionary different. I mean, I didn't invent music new, but I had things that on the banjo that maybe sounded a little bit more classical or had different influences, but there was no market for that. I played mainly events where people would drink a lot of alcohol or had a big, or just had a big party or even dress up as cowboys, you know. And, and I would stand there with the banjo and I'd be part of the catering team, you know, for that dream, for the people, for, you know, for the weekend. And there was no room for my music. But that was okay. I was just constantly writing more and more. And I had a friend in Italy, I still have, his name is Massimo Gatti. He's a really good mandolin player. And they were doing a line of new age music, for acoustic instruments, for a label called DDD. It was BMG Ariola later, bought by BMG. But they asked me, oh, you play this. He knew that I played, you know, this my music, which is a lot, you know, slower and different, you know, sounds and chord changes than you would normally find in bluegrass or traditional music. And he said, why don't you do one, you know, for that label? And I was really excited because now I, you know, could at least fill an album with my tunes. And so I did that and it encouraged me because, you know, I thought that's quite nice, you know. I liked to listen to it actually I like to listen to it back. You know, that's interesting. You know, most of the time, you know, I did recordings or worked on albums and I was never interested in listening to my own playing. Does that make sense? I never was a I'm still no fan of myself per se. but there was something satisfying in playing all the notes that I came up with and I liked and put them together and then arranged a bass for it. And and my brother, he plays guitar and he found the middle voices. So I think for me it was important that I could all of a sudden use some of my counter melody studies for setting the bass, for general bass, you know. So to have a melody and find really an interesting bass for it, I really realized this is something I enjoy tremendously. And then my brother would harmonize sort of the middle. And we became like a little trio where we would almost arrange the music like in a Baroque way. You have the melody, you have the general bass, and the middle voices are improvised, you know? And so my brother was very good, you know, in finding the right chords, or I could tell him the chords, of course. I knew by that time, of course, a lot about music theory because that was in the 90s, so I was already studying for many, many years, you know, music theory and counterpoint and composition and arranging and so forth. But, you know, it was never, but the music, I still, you know, the album wasn't very successful. It was in this line and was distributed worldwide, but I never got any money out of it or anything. But it was a very satisfying experience, you know, to have all of a sudden music that was sort of mine. Besides all the job that I did, you know, raising a family, being a musician. Uh-huh. Yeah, I don't know if you have kids, Jonathan, but, you know, I have two daughters now, they're grown up. And I would have to bring all the money in for the family. And I did that as a musician. Uh-huh. I had to do this as a musician. So I also learned electric guitar, studied jazz, and played over 200 shows every year, you know, in up to 17 bands.
Wow.
And that was from 1988 until 1998, you know, almost 10 years.
Uh-huh.
I played over 200 shows. 200 shows, sometimes 240 shows a year. And I was I was arranging for bands, had my own radio show on national radio. I would write arrangements and produce albums. And so I got more and more into music, you know, how it functions, functions. So that's a big word, how it functions. I don't know how it functions. I mean, navigate your way through the things that you interested in, you know. And so I did a few more solo albums, and of course, you know, with our band, we did more albums, and then I always wanted to write for orchestra because, you know, I always loved classical music, and I've written arrangements, but I've never, and in Switzerland, I was like, you know, I would really like to write something for chamber music, and they said, no, with banjo, you can't do that, you know, that was, that's not possible, you know, that's what they told me. And then
they said, hold on, they said it wasn't possible for you to do string music or quartet or orchestral music with a banjo. They told you that.
Yes, that was in Europe pretty much, you know, with the orchestras that I knew, they said, no, banjo doesn't work with that. That sounds terrible.
That's interesting.
That doesn't
crazy.
That doesn't sound good. Forget that, you know. And then, you know, in 97, we were invited to play with our band in America, and we started touring more and more, you know. In 2003, we moved with the family, with the kids, you know, my wife and the kids, you know, we all moved to America and moved to North Carolina because that would ensure me not being away from my family so much, you know, because I was... I was gone so much as a musician, which was very hard, you know, at times. And so when we were in America, that was easier, you know. I could drive home sometimes, or I could come home between little tour stretches and such. And then our former manager, you know, he lived in Maine, Bangor, Maine, and they have the Bangor Symphony. So I talked about that. I would like to write something, you know, for orchestra one day. And they said, why don't you write something for the Bangor Symphony Orchestra? And I said, well, why not, you know? And so I written a piece called Music from the Spring, which is like a romantic serenade or something, you know, of different pieces put together. It's like a pops. It's more like a pops thing, you know. It doesn't have development of themes and much. It's really tunes, you know, that I sort of arrange with orchestra and have orchestra play their own parts and such. And it's an 80-minute piece, you know, and I've written it for the Bangor Symphony Orchestra, which was a lot of fun sounded actually quite good. So I was quite pleased, you know.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No. I'm sorry. I may be talking too much.
No, it's great hearing it, actually. I'm just pushing to hear slightly more detail because do you think you went for, as you said, it's a pops thing. It doesn't really have development. And is there a reason you think you've started off going that direction with orchestral stuff? I mean, not everybody, but it's a wide open field. And so I'm asking why you were choosing that direction as your starting point.
Well, I don't know. I had so many tunes written that I thought would sound nice with orchestra, you know? And so I thought, why don't I start off with that? Because I wasn't experienced in writing for orchestra and, you know, so it was my first orchestra, you know, full symphony piece. And of course, you know, I had to apply a lot of things I've learned, but never really used. You know, so it was a lot of theoretical knowledge, but not practical. So I wasn't trying to get out too far on the limb. You know, does that make sense? Yeah.
Yeah. Did you have instrumentalists or conductor to work with to kind of help you with, or to at least guide whether or not the writing was sound or was going to work out? And
no,
a lot of people work with conductors or instrumentalists.
I did not work with instrumentalists. I worked with a conductor, but he just conducted, you know, once I was done.
Once it was finished. Okay. Yeah, in that case, you're very successful. Most people don't do that well their first time around. So.
I learned a lot, and I have to say I have a good listening background of classical music, and I understand the range of the instruments because I learned it, right? I also play enough violin myself that I know the positions
really?
And know what's possible and whatnot. And So, you know, and because it's community orchestra, you know, you're not going to write too complicated. Or if you have a passage that's complicated, you don't stretch it out too far so they can, you know, learn that in sections, you know, and then they have something to catch their breath again. Of course, you know, I did a few mistakes where I did a few rhythmic things that were just too difficult, you know. But, you know, it's a learning curve. But it was it sounded really nice because harmonically and structurally the whole thing was, you know, the sections and everything was written very solid. You know, I mean, I don't think that was there was much slack. You know, it was okay. You know, so but the music wasn't, you know, super original or experimental in a sense. You know, I just
right. Can I ask another question about that, though? What do you think you were writing complex rhythms that were too complex because of the way the syncopation works on the banjo, or the translation of that, or the attempt to translate that?
Yeah, if you had a passage that's like da ba da ba 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 da 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 ba da bum bum ba 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 da bum, you know, and that's too many off notes for a community orchestra, you know.
Okay. Interesting.
Uh-huh. So as long, you know, there's not enough ones, you know, definite ones that they start, you know, wandering off at one point. and, you know, and you learn, you know, I mean, if you really work with, if I could have, you know, if the Boston Pops would have asked me, I would have not written for them, not written for them because, you know, they were just, I am not maybe in that caliber of arranger or, you know. That I would, you know, make a fool out of myself, you know, and then, but with the orchestra Bangor, they're good people and they're nice, and it's community orchestra was really nice, and it was great, you know, to get a little experience with that. And then, you know, we started playing with lots more orchestras, you know, around the country, with Phoenix, with all kinds of symphonies. And all of a sudden asked us if we could play that piece, you know, and it's a very satisfying piece for people to listen to. So it was. It was good, you know. Yeah. It was good, and they could put it in their. They were able to put it in their pops, season, you know. And then, all of a sudden, I had a request to write for a string quartet, which I was really, super happy because, you know, I could write for four virtuosos. And string quartet playing is something that always fascinated me. And and there I could use a lot more skill, you know, for the and I could just really concentrate on four people, and that was a lot of fun. I enjoyed that more than anything I've ever done before. And then I've written Appalachian Concerto, which is really more, you know, of a romantic classical piece, you know, with themes that reoccur and develop, and, you know, the whole shebang. And, you know, so that was really fun, you know. And then there's more, you know, than I worked for the Banff Center. The Banff Center heard, they heard Appalachian Concerto, they liked it a lot. Anyway, I got a commission to write for the Banff Center a chamber music piece. And so that was 2011. And I've written Spirit of the Rockies for chamber. And then I did several more compositions for, you know, chamber music America.
Yes.
I did did it for them, and then, you know, several private, like Rhone Mountain Suite, and I just finished a piece last year for the Union Pacific, for the 200 year Golden Spike Memorial, right, with. For the town of Ogden and the Union Pacific, and that was with full symphony and ballet. So, and that was fun too.
So that's really interesting. I mean, that's a large output of stuff in recent times for involving orchestras and string quartets. Are you the combination of sort of folk things in with orchestral music is a large subject, and I'm wondering how is there a way in which in which your experiences writing for orchestras and chamber ensembles is impacting your playing and your presentation of stuff in the way that you do other things?
Yeah, I'm very lucky. You know, I'm working with my brother still. He plays guitar, and his background is a little different. He likes rock and roll and blues, and he likes traditional, you know, American folk music, and he's and he loves my music, you know. So this is fantastic. So he never doubts me, and he always, you know, really faithfully learns my music, and can't wait if I write something new. And I'm, you know, he's it's great, you know. And then Joel Landsberg, who plays bass with us, he's been with us almost 30 years. So there's like a very high level of understanding each other. I can really print him out the music, and it's really amazing. You know, right now I'm writing a new piece. You know, a new piece, and I play them parts or print something out for Joel, and I never get questioned. You know, they always say, "Oh, great!" You know, "Oh, wow!" Or, you know, they just love what I do. I'm a very luxurious position. You know, and I, you know, and they know I'm my worst self critic. You know, I have to say I'm a little bit in a lucky position also, because I don't need to prove creativity in a sense that I have to do necessarily something new. Like in the musical art world, there's a composition world, there's like, oh, if it's done before, don't do it because somebody else has already done it, right? And I'm very far away from all of that. You know, if there's something new that I come up with that's by accident something new, that's okay, but I'm not looking for it, right? I compose in a different manner. I keep journals, you know, if you're interested in the process, that is, maybe. For instance, you know, I did a piece for Roan Mountain, which I really loved doing. It's a beautiful era here in the Appalachians and State Park. So I went to visit the places and read a lot of history. And my brother, you know, when we drive or travel, he reads me history books, you know, about the place, or we talk about it. And it gives me pictures and inner ideas of certain scenes that sort of stick with me. And then I have a journal, always keep lots of journals, and I write in what I see, what I think is significant for me. Not, you know, what touches me really. Some occurrence, you know, or picture. And then I really describe it well in my journal, and then I find musical themes that fit that image for me, right? So
interesting.
You know, so I really work on the imagery of a place or a situation. I don't necessarily share that imagery with my audience, you know. I really need this to stay focused and on track for a longer piece of music, you know. So I collect themes, let's say, you know, for this new piece I'm writing. I collect themes. I'm in the theme collecting phase right now, which usually it takes, you know, 5-6 months, and then I have I have enough themes and pictures written in my journals that I have enough building materials to compose the piece. And then I construct pieces out of it. I determine which theme follows which, and then I orchestrate everything. Takes me usually about 5 to 6 weeks sitting in my room, and then I'm usually done. You know, so the process, you know, with all my other work is usually about a year, you know, for a new piece. Which is maybe 40 minutes long, or 42 minutes long, you know, something like that. But for me, it's very important to have the imagery. I found that if I don't have the images, I don't get creative. I need to have a frame for myself, something I make music for. I'll give you an example. I had a piece that I written for Chamber Music America, And I called it lucid dreamer, you know, because of the imagery. And I used very personal images. For instance, there was an image of my mother, you know, that I lost my mother when I was young. And so I like to think of her because I cannot remember that much, but I do. And so it was a beautiful process that I could write all the things down that I feel about her, or I would like to know about her, or things that struck me. And so there was a few themes that developed out of that, and I could make a piece with really my mother in mind, with a little controversy in it, and you know, all the things that happened. But the frame, making music for something, is like, I compare it with a carpenter who maybe walks down to its workshop, and now he can make a chair, right? So he can say, well, let's say my brother, he's got a, you know, he can't get by, you know, I don't know, maybe he's handicapped, maybe he cannot really sit well in the chair, right? So let's make a chair that works for him, right? So there's a purpose. And then he has to be creative because he has to think, oh, okay, so the chair needs to be this height, needs to have, you know, an armrest here, and it needs to be maybe open on the side, or, and there's all kinds of things that all of a sudden, you know, he needs to be creative with because there's a frame, you know? And if if a carpenter then just, you know, would go down to the shop and says, I make a chair, well, why and for who, right? And so he maybe gets stuck because he doesn't know why he's doing anything, right, down there, right? Uh-huh. Now. Unless, you know, he has a commission for something specific, you know? And I have to give myself an whole catalog of small commissions to finish a big commission, you know?
Uh-huh.
So that's why I need all these different pictures that sort of collectively, you know, become this bigger picture. And I can make little snippets of music for each of these pictures that sort of... And there's interesting... there's an interesting process because, you know, when it's, say, you can have a picture in your mind, or you can read it, or you can lay it actually in front of you. Let's say you take a picture of your dog or your children or whatever, something that's important to you, something that you want to keep your mind with for a while, and you lay that in front of you and you start playing music, you instantly know, you instantly know if that what you're playing is not disturbing your imagery, right? And the non-disturbance of the imagery is my motivator in the creative phase. So I instantly know, oh, this doesn't fit at all to this imagery that I have. And so I don't do it. So I've tried to find something else. And I usually end up, you know, in the end with the things that disturb it the least, you know? It's not. I sometimes find something that actually enhances the imagery, but that's asking a lot already. You know, sometimes that happens, but a lot of times it's really just something that doesn't disturb this imagery, right? It's not taken away from it, and that can take a long time, especially when you. But the nice thing is because the images are all different. And they're all distinct and very much carved out because I write a lot of pages about each image. I really force myself to be honest with a certain image, and I have to confess. You know, I failed. I have failed. You know, in images I have written down, I couldn't find anything that, you know, I could really play to that. It just didn't work, you know, just couldn't do it. But usually, if I look long enough, all of a sudden the door opens, you know. Sometimes I dream it, or I get up in the morning, make a coffee, I have a little snippet, and it goes on. And I learned a little bit over the years to trust that with a lot of hours and a few days going by, I usually find openings, and I find things that actually are right. And then... You see, I can work on that imagery and finish that with the snippets I have, and then I move to another imagery, and that makes me not be the same all the time, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That, you know...
Well, this is... Carry on. Sorry, I didn't. I thought you were silent again. Keep going. It's fascinating listening.
You know, because otherwise, you know, when I pick up my instrument every day, I usually play the things that I just played or just like to hear right now, or they're easy to play or make me feel well because I play them or I'm able to play them. And mm-hmm. they're usually quite repetitive. You know, they're usually things that I can already play. So my development is very slow, right? So my musical development seems very, very slow. And then I could go to YouTube and, you know, listen to somebody talk about some jazz substitutions or whatever, you know, or open one of my books or read a story about class. That's all very inspiring. But it's very difficult then to use these things in a context. You know, it's mm-hmm. very difficult to use music theory in context. I get faster for I can roll much faster forward in my case today when I have a strong image about something I want to make music for.
And then, this is very interesting. Go ahead. Sorry.
I'm maybe talking too much.
No, you're really not. I find it very generous that you're exposing this much about your process and your technique. So carry on, please. Don't let me stop you there.
No, and of course, you know, I've learned, like most, you probably did yourself. You know, we learned all the scales and the altered scales and all the whole tone scales mm-hmm. and whole tone half tone scales and how to use them in all keys. You know, and how to substitute and how to do this and, you know, the tritonal substitution and, you know, all the things that we know, all the things that we learn. And of course, you know, I studied counterpoint with the book of Fuchs, you know, and with all kinds of, you know, composition. I have my composition books. But in the end, you know, that's really, really important for certain things. But I find myself not thinking about any of that when I compose. Because I only, in the end, when I actually arrange, you know, I call it arranging. The composing part is for me the theme, putting the themes uh-huh. together, coming up with melodies, which is a mystical part for me, an actual melody that grabs me, you know, that actually I find to be really true. There's no theory really for that. And that's why it fascinates me still, because I can learn how to set a cello and the chords, you know, and I know the double stops, so I can see, you know, oh, he could do that. And it's like a toy store where I can choose from a lot of options that I know. But I can mm-hmm. but I can only use these options if I have a melody or strong themes that I can work with, right? So the melodies, you know, and I'm melody oriented. I'm more melody oriented than fragment oriented. So, which is maybe a little old fashioned. I don't know. And
they're both old fashioned.
And then, you know, and then of course, you know, there's the other aspect in my life, you know, where I sit with Uwe and Joel and we just play and jam and Uwe sings a Grateful Dead song and we just, you know, we just experiment on some fiddle tunes and, you know, just noodle around and doodle. I think the playful factor is very important for me still. Uh-huh. You know, my brother and I, me and Joel, you know, we can sit and we have a wonderful drummer here with us as well now for, you know,
I saw in the videos, yes.
And, you know, he's a really good guy, you know. And, I mean, we're just having a good time. I think with my music, I maybe could have never supported my family that way. I think it's a good addition to what we do with my brother singing and the entertainment we have for people as musicians. You know, I think there's a package, you know, that people come to see us and it's not overly sophisticated.
But it has its
moments, you know, where it's getting maybe a little complicated.
I'm sure that appeals to different people. You know, there's different people are drawn in, and you know, so you're getting wider number of people probably from it.
Yeah, and of course, you know, we're not hugely famous, you know, but we're doing fine. You know, we can all live. I mean, this year is a challenge, of course. But
for everyone in the world, I
yeah,
think.
Of yeah. course it is, you know. But let's say, you know, for the last 40 years, we were able to really live off the music well. So with ups and downs, but that's, I mean, that's very much luck, you know. And so with my brother, I'm having one spectrum, you know, a little bit more of the classical, more of the composition, and you know, my brother doesn't read music. But my brother has other qualities, you know. He's a rock and roller. He's a punk. Uh-huh. He's a punker, and he's a fun guy, and he and he's a good singer, and he's got a lot of soul and heart. And I think together we have a certain. We're really, it sounds a little corny maybe, but together we're actually really more.
Yeah. You know. Well, it's great. I mean, you know, to work closely with the same person, and especially it's your brother, so there's an even closer tie. But that's a special thing in music. I mean, you know, you can't. I never think you can replace the sort of developed telepathy that happens between people across a lifetime if they have that, regardless of what their technical limitations might be. You know, there's a communication thing that's profound that happens.
Yeah. So whenever I sit down and play, you know, I usually compose. You know, I try to come up with things. I usually try to come up with things, and not on a theoretical basis. You know, not.
Let me ask a question about that. Can I ask a question about that before we go on? I want you to include whatever you're going to say, but I want to ask. So it seems to me, in a lot of what you just said about writing, it didn't occur to me while you were talking that it was bound down by the banjo so much. It was more about sound and the way you hear things and about the images and whatnot. And then, am I wrong in that? And then, because now you were going to go start talking about sitting down with the banjo and working things out, or working things out with an instrument. So I'm wondering about the two things, like what's heard and what is bound by instrumental technique and the binding to an instrument. Oh, wow. I mean, now you're a famous banjo player, so I feel like maybe I'm stretching, going outside the boundary of maybe what you want to talk about. If so, you can
No. I'm all good. All good, Jonathan. It's all good. You know, everybody's limited. I mean, maybe there's a few people that are not, but I'm definitely, you know, I mean, I feel limited on my instrument. I mean, especially the range of the instrument is limited, you know, and then my abilities to play every note at any given point is limited, you know. The instrument has advantages and has disadvantages. I mean, like every instrument has, you know, and so I have written things that I just can't play. They're not possible for me to play, but they're actually very, you know, playable on a violin, for instance. And then there's things, you know, that I can play that a violin can't hardly play. You know, it's just almost impossible, or is impossible. Mm-hmm. When I want to find melodies, I get inspired, you know, playing on my instrument, because I find, you know, positions and structures, you know, that the instruments offers, you know, me to explore certain things. Certain things just sound good, you know, on a specific instrument. And but then when I have a melody, I a lot of times sit there and then try to figure out the melody in my head, you know. How does it go? Maybe I have an opening, you know, on the banjo that sounds good on the banjo, and then I realized a lot of times I have something that is good, but I don't know how to go from here, right? And my way out of that dead end, you know, sometimes, you know, for a piece of music, is that I sit down and don't play the instrument. I think this melody that I have. That I already found on the instrument, maybe, but then I sit down and I think of how does it go on. I dream of it, how it goes on. You know, what do I want to hear? And then I sometimes sing that onto a voice recorder that I don't forget it. You know, because my mind then is free. I can open the door with the thing I found on the banjo, maybe, or and then I can just sort of my mind wanders off in this dream. Because it opened that door, and then I can just sing it to myself, and I say, oh, this is actually where I really wanted to go. And when I'm looking at the instrument, I would not go there, because, you know, I would think of the instrument again. And and so the liberation of the instrument comes at a point when I once have a few portals open, you know, then I can sort of find them. And then sometimes, you know, I've struggled to actually play them what I thought. And it takes me, most of the time I'm lucky and I can learn it in a reasonable amount of time. And I had a few passages. I'm almost in every concerto I've written. I have one or two of these passages where I just really, before the concert, I always think, why in the world do I put myself through this? because there's a pretty good chance I'm not going to really nail it. But I go for it. I do it, and you're a musician yourself. You know what I'm talking about. You have to give yourself some slack as well. Sometimes, you know, and don't. I'm a perfectionist, actually, which I don't think is a bad thing. But there needs to be a sort of a forgiveness also to oneself.
I think it's lovely for people to hear that, because if you watch, your banjo style is so rigorous. Compared to some, that it's astonishing, and so it's nice. I think it's probably great that you just said that.
Well, you know, I'm also there's a little bit of a sometimes attention deficit. Maybe I don't know. My mind wanders off, or I can't concentrate only on the music. I think of other kinds of things, and. And some days, you know, I can really concentrate and I feel like I'm a machine. I can really play like a machine. And then other days, you know, it's just my timing is a little off, and or the banjo is a little out of tune, or I just doesn't feel right. And I get affected by these things. And then I maybe just don't, I'm not at my best. But that's just how it is. I think everybody is going through phases like that. But most of the time, I realized also, you know, a little... you know, everybody has his little tricks, you know, of how to get out of holes again, you know. And one of my tricks is that I don't try to pay too much attention to myself, you know, when I play. Sometimes, you know, when I really feel like I'm not in the music zone, you know, then I realize I'm staring too much on my fingers, trying to play everything too good. You know, I have to let it go a little bit and trust my muscle memory and trust my imagination. And if there's a little note or a pull off that wasn't quite as, you know, precise or as clean or as pristine as I would have liked it to be, I shouldn't, you know, concentrate on that. I should just let the music flow. And then I just, you know, sort of look around. I look at Uwe, see what he does, and look at Joel, and, you know, just sort of try to take the focus away from myself. And that usually helps a lot, you know. That usually loosens me up, you know, because then I start to hear the music and just sort of be in the music with the others, and all of a sudden something else takes over, and I'm much happier than, you know.
So in other of your interviews, I heard you talking about that you don't, you know, of course you improvise, but you don't like to do it in your shows. You like your shows to be very, very, very prepared and carried out in a certain way. But I'm interested in when you were talking about writing and images and looking for things, how much improvisation on your instrument you do in order to find things.
You're talking about doing the composition process?
Yeah.
At home, I doodle and noodle and, you know, for hours. You know, I mean, I just noodle around on my banjo, try this and that and the other, and, you know, probably like every other musician, you know. Then I have pieces I really practice. I just, you know, practiced the piece from our show we did last week, and I over-practiced, you know. I over-practiced, and now I hurt my finger a little bit, and it takes a week for it to heal. Really, again, because I just sort of like going with the head through the wall, you know. And I really wanted to play good, and then I over practice, and then my hands get weak, and the next day I can't hardly play at all anymore, and don't it doesn't feel right. But I improvise actually. I improvise a lot in the songs Uwe sings, you know. Like when we play with the string quartet, of course, there's not much improvisation, you know. I really want the things set because everything I do is in relation to what everybody else is doing, and I want that to be what I I want that to be what I wanted it to be. And because there's a lot of, you know, things go there's a lot of things going on. And so I there's improvisation, but not much. Most improvisation, you know, is if I make a mistake and how do I get out of it? That's when improvisation comes really handy. You know. But when Uwe sings a song, you know, that, like for instance, in this Corona crisis, you know, we just we do two shows a week, two times 50 minutes about with the pre-show and everything of music. And we played, I think, close to 180 songs now. Different, and we only repeated about 12 songs, you know. So we recorded about 160 different songs, you know, and it's and there, you know. Of course, there's a lot of improvisation and a lot of, you know, just sort of go with the flow. And I like to do that, you know, because it's also bringing me something back. I've not done so much. You see, when people pay you money and you go to a theater and people come, and maybe you're tired and you're on the road. You want to make sure that your program is good, you know. So you you play what you know works for you, and you want to play and have fun with it, and not be devastated. So it's nice if you have something that has really worked out, and if you really feel well, you can sort of wander off a little bit or do other things. But it's good to. But for me, it's a very good, you know, thing to have. The music worked out to a degree where I know I can give a good concert. You know, I don't I don't have to rely on my my mood tonight. I can execute a good show and have fun with it. You know, and that made that, you know, with the amount of shows we played over the years and the amount of travel, that's I think almost a necessity for me. You know, because then the program also becomes like a ritual, you know, a little bit. And it gives a stability into my life. We have certain things that we do at soundcheck, certain tunes that we hardly ever play on the show, but we know it's our soundcheck tunes. I even have things that we do that I play behind the curtain before we go on stage. It's an intro to a piece of music that's in a different tuning, but I play it on the regular tuning, which sounds completely bizarre, but but it's just the finger memory that flies through these passages in the wrong tuning. But everybody, like Joel and Uwe, they know that's like a ritual, you know. So before we go out, Joel sometimes, hey, play it, you know. So I have to play it, and it brings us back, you know, to our to where we are. Because last night we might played in London, and the next day in Manchester, and then we fly and we play here, and then we go to Seattle, then we go to Australia, then we go to, you know, nonstop. You know, we've been on the road almost 200 days a year, you know, for the last 23 years with this band, and and so it's you have to develop certain rituals, otherwise, you know, you go crazy. Maybe being away so much and so different, so many different places. So the stage becomes the home, you know. Playing the notes you're familiar. And
yeah, that's the direction it works.
You know, I mean, it becomes something solid, something that is really important for everybody on the road.
So then it must be, so as you were saying before, it's nice when you get to just stretch out and let go of that when you're around. I'm just thinking it's interesting on the other thing about the banjo that is interesting, or it seems like you grew up interested in so many people that are improvising and fly by the seat of their pants. I mean, a lot of people worked out stuff, but that it must be interesting to go back to that. I mean, does it feel like you're going back in time to some earlier?
Yes, I do.
Earlier.
But I have to tell you something. I when I was young, I thought all the music was improvised. You know, then I listened to a lot of, you know, live shows of Louis Armstrong or Flatten Scruggs, and I realized they don't vary much. Even though it sounds like it's improvised, it's not improvised. It's 90% of it is quite set. And then if I hear the improvisation and really listen to it, of people who say they always improvise, well, it's the same licks or positions. They combine in a little bit of different ways. It's not that much. Uh-huh. It's not that much new stuff. You know, it's not every night that they're improvising new.
Well, no, they have their language. It's like carrying a sentence.
Yeah, yeah, you have you have the riffs, you know, and you have the things you do, and you know. So, and even if I listen to the there's bands out there that pretty much play every note the same over years and years and years and years, and I we don't do that. Definitely not.
That's a little too far.
No, we don't do that. We don't, especially when Uwe Joel and me are on stage, and sometimes, you know, on stage, you know, I just call out. I just like this thunder out here. I just call out a tune that we have not played in months or even years, and we just and then we just do it. You know, of course not if it's a let's say, you know, a very important gig.
Yeah,
maybe something a little less, you know, and you know, you get challenges. Uh-huh. You know, I mean, when you're we've been playing for so long, and a few years ago I got very ill, and I had to have quite a few operations and had to stay home for a month, and then I went straight back on tour, and that summer, you know, we played with the Contras Quartet for a big fundraiser of a classical radio station in Chicago, and because of all the anesthesias, I had some blackouts sometimes, you know, that while playing, all of a sudden, there was no warning. It was just, you know, just like the flow of thought would just quit. And I would sit there. I wouldn't even know where I am and who I am and what this instrument is. What am I doing here?
Wow.
And it would come without a warning. It would just, you know, just be there all of a sudden. And you realize it. You realize it in the moment. It's there. No, you don't feel it coming or anything. And it's scary. So I had these.
Yeah.
So we were on the road and we played all these shows, and I realized all of a sudden, you know, I would maybe 3-4 times per night just sort of have this little moment. I don't think people would notice it, you know, because I sort of keep on playing a few notes and I'm find myself right back into it. But then when we played with the Contras Quartet for that fundraiser, it's very structured music. It's every note is set, and every note is really right there. Very complicated, for me, complicated. And then we played, you know, and I had a few blackouts that really were devastating, you know, where I would really lose an entire passage. And that was really, really, really hard to deal with, because never anything like that I have had happened in my life before, and now I'm over that. This is not happening anymore. But it happened almost 1.5 years, I would say, off and on, you know, and that was scary. It really was.
Yeah.
But now, looking back, I feel like it helped me to also let go sometimes, not take it too serious, you know? because you know when you're a tense person like maybe me, I'm a tense person, always practiced a lot, worked really hard, studied a lot, write a lot of music, and I'm constantly at it. You almost like a sports person for the brain, you know. You force yourself more and more and more. You push yourself more and more. You never push yourself less. You know what I mean?
I had the experience. I mean, I know I had a big surgery a few years back, and it's your brain is something. You're working with something else all of a sudden, and you have to figure out a way to accept it. It's not easy.
Yes, it's very difficult. So that was a challenge, and actually. And now Corona, of course, you know, staying at home. We were very, very, very lucky that we instantly bought equipment. You know, we bought more more cameras and, you know, iPhone holders and lamps and and, you know, trying to make a show, you know, that we could provide people with. And in the beginning, the views were good for us, you know. And then when the country opened up a little bit and the springtime was there, for everybody, I think the views went down because people started to go out
again. Uh-huh, yes.
And now they're picking up again. So because we're doing these shows, we're doing just two shows, you know, one Friday night, one Saturday night, every week. And we have we're just relentless, you know, just keep on doing the shows. And with the donations... We will not be able to survive forever like that, but it definitely, you know, brought us this far, this far along, and it probably, you know, I hopefully will, and I think so. We were just lucky that we had enough of a fan base on Facebook, and you know that people and loyal fans that would say, okay, we give you a few bucks. Every time, you know, we see you, that in the end, you know, it adds up to actually a way of life, you know.
Uh-huh. So I have one last question because, you know, you've spoken very generously for all this time, and I realize I'm not a very question, but it's mostly because it's interesting listening to you talk. There's no reason for me really to keep interjecting with interruption. But what I would want to ask, because you have developed so much, and as you said, some things are like you're always pushing. Still, it's in your personality. Do you have any real ambitions for anything that you haven't gotten to yet, or things that you want to cover, or directions that you want to go, things you want to accomplish?
Yes, I'm constantly working on new compositional styles, I'm really working on more theme development, you know, just get away from the melody a little bit more, not being so bound to the melody. That's what I'm trying. You know, I can just sit down and write something that's like that, you know, just write it and, you know, out of, you know, just develop it, you know, on a theoretical emotional base, right? But I would like to be able to like it as much as the melodies I come up with. So I'm struggling a little bit, you know, with that aspect. And also I want to write better for string quartet. I constantly listen to string quartet arrangements, and I try to understand better how I could use the textures, you know, how I could use the textures that other people have used for my music as well.
I found it interesting in your music. I found it interesting that you play on, there was so little pizzicato out of the strings as I listened to as much of your string music as I could. And I thought that was rather ironic considering you play such a plucky instrument.
Pizzicato?
Yeah, there wasn't a lot going on in the strings of the string quartet.
No,
because that was funny. Cause it...
No, there's not that much pizzicato going on. I mean, I do have pizzicato in it. And
yeah. Well, I just thought it was interesting because it's, as you mentioned, there's all these great composers that have written that have included folk music from Bartok and all that. And one of Bartok's things is it's loaded with, sort of recreations of folk techniques and stuff like that in the strings. And I thought it was, for some reason, I don't know why, it just occurred to me. You can tell me to shut up.
No. It's interesting. I have never really thought about that yet. I use pizzicato here and there, and I don't know. I mean, maybe because the banjo is already covering so much Bing. the banjo is already doing so many short notes that, I don't know, maybe I'm not looking for that many short notes of my...
All right.
Of my fellow warriors.
Yeah, well, yeah. When I say that, you can imagine the horror if somebody asks you to bow the banjo at this point. You'd probably be like, what?
I know. It's the nice thing is when you're a banjo player, nobody really takes you serious to begin with anyway. A lot of people. So you have a little bit of a jester status, and it's always nice, if people then, it happened to us quite a lot that we worked with string quartets around the country, and they think, it's going to be country, it's easy, and it's blah, blah, blah. And we send them the scores and they rehearse and we get together, and then they realize, oh, this is actually challenging, right? This is not, and then sometimes a little, and then they come and say, wow, I didn't know that on the banjo and blah, blah, blah. And then it's nice, it's nice to have, it's sometimes nice to go somewhere and there's not much expectation, And then turn them around, see, that was really something that is enjoyable, or enjoyable to play. That was really a lot of fun. We just did with a nice string quartet from the Dallas Symphony. We did a festival. That's such a great experience, because they never worked with people like us, and they were so happy. I mean, then they see the glow on their faces and have them on the stage, and it was just it's awesome, So as a but if I would come, as this artist and I'm wearing a scarf, and I would come there and I'm blah 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 and have and then I also have to deliver something that's really strange, or weird, or I have to belong to a, and I don't have to, as a banjo player, I don't have to do anything, I can really do what I like, I already have this freedom. It's actually really good, I like to be in this position. I see that now. When I was younger, people would come to me and say, yeah, you're so talented, so why do you play banjo? Or, or why don't you learn a real instrument, or...
All right.
And, the banjo for me, was always a place where I thought where people play banjos must be a happy place, it's not about being sophisticated or anything. It's just, I used to read, Samuel Clemens, of how they, I would dream about America and going up and down the Mississippi River on a steamboat, and there's people playing banjos. There's this American sort of idea with the banjo soundtrack, maybe totally romantic, nothing to do with reality. I don't know. But it was my reality. It was my reality. I loved that idea. I thought I want to be there where it's like what I think it is, right? And the banjo and the banjo was the soundtrack to that. When I was a child and I had all my friends, they had to go to, or wanted to go, let's say, to accordion lessons or piano or had to go to classical guitar. And they would go from school where it was really, school, and then instead of having fun, and for some people, of course, school is fun, but instead of going home and doing what they like to do or just want to do, they went then to go to lessons. And I could go home and just take my banjo out, and because there was nobody that could play banjo, I never felt bad about my own music. Do you know? Nobody, you know, I was in a very beautiful situation where there was nobody that could play better than me that I knew, because I knew nobody that played banjo. So there was a, there was not constantly somebody that was doing already what I wanted to do right around me, right beside me, or would constantly tell me what I would do wrong. So there was an unlimited amount of joy and freedom when I played as a child. So looking back, of course, I could have learned a lot of things quicker being able to go to music school or, you know, learning, you know, scales and such. But I, on the other hand, discovered an entire world of happiness and imagination that I maybe would not have gotten if I would have gone to another school, you know? And and then actually filling in the dots later with the music theory was fairly easy, you know, when I say so. Because when you are already playing this stuff, you know, I mean, if you, if you've gone from a G7 to when you go from a G7 to C, for instance, right? As a child, you know, I learned that from my mother, you know, that look, that sounds good, you know. Later, of course, you learn, you know, it's a counterpoint, F to E, B to C, right? And then you could also see, oh, it's a B diminished, oh, and or and then you learn, oh, no, it's a dominant seven. And, you know, forever, and for every musical time of the past 800 years, you have some explanation for that phenomenon, you know? But when you already play that phenomenon, it's so easy to learn the music, the theory behind it. Similar, like when you already speak a language, you can learn the grammar easier sometimes than learning to speak through the grammar, you know? So that's why children, you know, they speak before they go to school and learn how to read and write. And I feel like that's what happened to me also as a child. So so I'm not saying people shouldn't go to music school, not at all. But in my case, school was a struggle. So I was at least having something at home that I could be free from that struggle, you know. And so music music opened that for me. And that was and that was beautiful, you know. That was really good.
That's great. Well, I think it's been wonderful hearing the hearing you speak on the direction that we went in today. And if there's any, is there anything else you'd like to talk about? Because otherwise, I think we can conclude the interview.
Yeah, I know. I speak a lot and get carried away, but
oh no, it's no problem. I can talk about music all day, Jens, and you know we're happy to put it up. So you know, I think really, I think it thanks a lot. You know,
I think the beauty. If I want to just say something, you know, I think the beauty in music is that there's no set rule in music. There's no actual rule in music, you know? I mean, if you want to compose in a certain style, well, then you better use the rules, you know? Like if you want to do 12-tone music, well, you start off, you know, building your matrix and, you know, you do all these things. And and if you want to play jazz, well, you have to learn this and these chord changes and you learn the 2-5-1. You know, you learn all these... you have to learn certain things and rules, you know, in order to learn the language of the people you're probably going to be playing with if you like a certain style of music. But still, you know, in the end, you can do whatever you like. You don't, you know, I've met people that, you know, work really hard in a different job and then they play a little guitar and sing. And I don't think they have any less joy in music than I do than I have. So I think that, because my mother and my father, they both played guitars and accordions and harmonicas, and we sang every day at home.
Yes,
real, you know, just singing. And there was no, my father played, you know, very simple chords on the guitar, but I cannot remember, you know, how many times, you know, we would sit there. And we literally had tears of joy in our, you know, tears of joy, singing, being as a family together, playing. And that's what music can do, you know, and that's why I'm also happy to be a folk musician because that's part of the folk music. You know, you're with people together, and it's not always about how complicated or complex things are. They can be very simple or, uh-huh. and very beautiful, just like an honest piece of bread with a piece of butter on it.
Lovely. Yeah.
All right. Well, I appreciate. Great. Well, I want to say I appreciate you very much asking me to talk to you. You have made great,
thank you.
great. You had amazing people on your show, and so it's really beautiful to be.
Part. And you're one of them now, so that's great. And it's you know, it's wonderful for us, and wonderful for me as an interviewer, because I have had the opportunity to interview some really great banjo players, and you're one of them. And so thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you. Yes.
And I hope all the best. I hope you get. I hope you. Do fare well through the current difficulties, but also that you get to, you know, move through your career as you wish. And
that's very kind of you, and I hope that we someday will meet. Okay.
I hope so, Jens. Take care.
Well, you take care. All the best to you. Bye bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. See you later. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
You've been listening to the Banjo Studio Podcast with your host Jonathan Frelick. Head over to banjostudio.com for a great selection of American-made banjos and Collings guitars.